Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. You're injecting an intensity into summer vacation Greatest Discovery that I wasn't expecting. I'm recording from a hammock right now.
Oh, yeah?
You're making me have to sit up straight, and that's incredibly hard in a hammock.
I was wondering why I heard all those shorebirds calling out in the background and the unmistakable scrape of a cocktail umbrella against your microphone foam.
I'm eating soft shell crab. I don't actually think I've ever had a soft shell crab. That's the crab where you eat the whole thing, shell and all, right?
You've never had that?
No. What's that like?
Oh, man. We gotta get you some soft shell crab. It's a real treat.
That's an East Coast thing, right? Like if we go to Washington D.C. for a tour stop, that's what we would do there.
Like I suppose
Baltimore thing, like with the bay.
Well, here's the thing: all crabs have a soft shell phase. It's just about when, where in the molting cycle they are when you catch them.
Oh, this is like the veal of crabs. You're getting them when they're young. Is that the deal?
When they're young, it's like the, I think that periodically they're like snakes. They have their shell doesn't grow. They have to like slough it off and then grow a new one. So there's like a period of time where crabs are soft little guys, and you batter them and fry them, and they're delicious.
Is the ocean floor littered with these sloughed off crab shells?
Yeah, it's a real mess down there. I mean, we feel bad about all the plastic we're dumping into the ocean, but really it's the crabs that should be ashamed of themselves.
There's just a sloughed off crab shell island floating in the middle of the Pacific.
Hey, speaking of delicious delights, I was talking to our buddy Adam Ragusa the other day, who made the theme song of this show among all of our Star Trek shows.
I'm surprised he had time for you.
I know, he's a big time YouTube celebrity now, but I was talking to him about the Picard trailer and how they show the Chateau Picard wine. That's kind of like the main thing in the trailer.
Yeah.
And we were talking like there's got to be like some recipes we can do featuring that wine, assuming that gets released, and then like maybe there could be a little Greatest Gen Adam Ragusa YouTube cooking channel crossover.
We could do a beef bourguignon.
Beef blah blah blah. Feliz beefy bee. Yeah, I mean, like, it seems impossible that they would not have a branded Chateau Picard red wine product available, right?
God, you know that's coming, and it's going to be garbage, though, right?
It'll be bad. But, you know, like, the good thing is, like, you don't want to cook with, like, the fanciest wine in the world. And I think it will be good for cooking.
Okay.
But it'll probably be, like, $25 a bottle, which kind of is more than I want to spend.
Attainable for most, as a novelty, I would say.
Right, but not, like, I don't know.
I'd say if I'm buying wine that I know I'm going to cook with, I'm going for the like 10 and under kind of price category.
Mad Dog.
Maybe the way we should destroy the Millennium Falcon is with a bottle of Chateau Picard. Like in the beginning of Star Trek Generations, it's just like a 5-minute slow motion video of the bottle spinning towards the completed kit. That's the movie.
That is the movie, man.
That's that would be
just
great.
Just rolling credits over it.
Ben, we've been making too much work for ourselves. I think this is all we need to do.
We're going to have to get a camera that shoots at an insanely high frame rate to get the weightlessness effect.
Oh, we've got
from
that.
A bottle that we have launched with enough kinetic energy to shred a Lego Millennium Falcon.
You know, one thing that I neglected to say during the live show for Top Gun that we did for Friendly Fire was that they shot all of the model work with high-speed cameras, and in order to make the, like, so you shoot those sequences in super high frame rate, and then you slow them down because it makes model work look real, like that transfer right. of speed. And so to sell the effect, they hooked up a cordless drill to the bottom of each camera with, and that drill is connected to a bit connected to a wooden disc whose center punched hole is off center. And so they had a camera assistant hit the button for the drill, and so it would spin the out of axis wooden dowel to shake the camera in such a way that when it was shooting during high speed, you would get like a realistic camera wobble that worked with the frame rate change.
Right. Because there's like, there's not just like the shaky cam effect that I'm sure that contributes to, but also like a, like the pin register in a film camera is, it's not a flawlessly precise operation, like where each frame winds up in front of the opening, the aperture.
Yeah.
Like in, and you see this in like if you watch an old film, like if you look at like titles, they kind of float a little bit on screen because they're shot on separate film and then there's like a process, but that kind of exposes the float that you would normally never notice.
Yeah, so that's all by way of saying I think we have a plan and a process. I have a cordless drill. I have two of them.
I think what we need to do, because I want to get this done sooner rather than later. I don't want to get hamstrung by the Star Trek industrial complex taking a long time to get the Chateau Picard wine out on the market.
Uh huh.
I discovered on some deep, dark corner of Reddit, somebody had like meticulously played back that trailer and made a copy of the label that you can download as like
Perfect.
A Photoshop document. So we'll make our own Chateau Picard.
Awesome! I love it. I love that we used our Marin to totally pre-produce this thing.
Let's get a little work done.
Yeah. Very efficient.
Yeah. And, you know, a glancing reference to the existence of that trailer, which I'm sure we would have heard about if we hadn't mentioned.
Right.
Do you want to get into the second half of the Captain Saru comic book, Adam?
I sure do, Ben. Let's finish this baby up. It's the second half of the Star Trek Discovery annual comic book. It's called Captain Saru, and we're picking it up at around page 26.
So when we left off, the crew of the Dorothy Garrad had been captured by the Orions, and they're in cells that are, they're commenting on how garbagey these cells are. How embarrassed the Orions should be to have constructed their ship out of actual metal, et cetera, et cetera. But Tilly has the first line in this second half of the comic book. It's one of those S edits of comics where it's her line, but on a panel that Saru is in. And she's saying, "I have faith in Discovery's captain." So this is a pretty desperate deal, right? Like the idea that that all of these Starfleets are going to be killed or sold into slavery, and that the only price to secure their safety that the Orions will accept is the entire Starship Discovery.
This is an instance of a setup and a potential payoff, one of many in this half of the comic book, I think. And I think as we summarize it, we will talk about how none of these setups are really paid off in the way that you think.
Yeah.
Like the idea of a Federation Starship crew being sold into slavery, like that is a 10 out of 10 scandal were right. it to ever happen.
That would be, I would say, like grounds for Starfleet to like go to war with the Orions, right?
Right. And what this book effectively does is it takes these larger matters and reduces them into these micro aggressions. Yeah. Like we never really understand the threat here at a larger level, which I think is appropriate. Like this feels very comic booky as a story.
Right. Saru gets back on the FaceTime with the captain of the Orion ship, and he makes a deal with her, basically like this: you can have Disco, and then what you have to do is put everybody back on the Dorothy Garrod, and also give them the tools they need to fix that ship up so that she can fly out of there. Which you know, it's one of those dramatic moments where you see it feels like too high a price to give up to the bad guys.
Right.
It's a surprising move. It does not seem it's hard to wrap your mind around Saru making this deal.
And Vera, the Orion captain, does not seem caught off guard by the acceptance of her terms. She's like, "Cool, just like I planned it."
Yeah, she's like, "Say that again, but more explicit."
And, like, there is no passage of time here. It's almost instantaneous that these crews are swapped.
Right.
I like to imagine that there are people at stations around the ship who are not hip to this plan, who are just appearing on the Dorothy Garrod, like, the fuck is this?
Yeah, because, like, the bridge crew beams onto the Dorothy Garrod, and is it Michael that says, "We're back aboard the Dorothy Garrod"?
Yeah.
Just like, okay, thanks. Thanks for telling us.
Yeah.
Do we ever find out what happened with Tilly's dad?
Nope.
He's not a character in the issue, is he?
He is not.
Maybe he's one of those beefy hunks that is also among those that beam aboard the bridge.
A lot of beef in this comic.
Yeah. Everybody's very sexy. All the drawings are very sexy, I would say.
I mean, that's an Orion thing.
Yeah. But I feel like the Starfleets are also drawn very sexy.
Yeah.
What I'm saying, it's a very jackable comic book.
Jeez. I did not feel that way.
You didn't categorize this with your Star Trek hentai when you were putting it up on the shelf?
Did not.
My species has the ability to sense the coming.
So the Orions are aboard the Disco, and it's not just Vera, it's her crew of absolute units, and they are like swarming through the halls, like doing a room by room, hallway by hallway takeover of the ship. And there is from the shadows the appearance of some John McClaning happening as these scout crews roam among the ship.
It's everything from like coconutting a couple of Orion heads together by like hands with an unseen operator to, you know, like he's blasting them. He's using plants to gas them.
Yeah.
Are those the plants in his quarters, or are those the plants in the, are those like the mushrooms on the mycelial?
It looked like the mushroom greenhouse to me as a location, but it didn't look to me like it's what they do normally.
Right.
Ben, they sort of gave it away when you see the dog penis fingers of the frame of the Orion heads cracking together. Like I almost wish Saru was wearing gloves, you know, to sort of not spoil the surprise.
Yeah, I liked the homage of the turbo lift opening and there being a dead Orion there with blood written on his chest. Now I have a machine gun. Ho ho ho.
I love that.
Ho, ho,
Saru is so dangerous hand to hand, but you don't ever see any mule kicks here.
Yeah, I also thought his feet looked a little weird. Like, there's definitely frames in this comic book where you see his feet where they look like the hoofs.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like other parts where he's like clamming around in Jeffrey's tubes and his feet are visible and they just look like regular feet.
Yeah.
And like there's like one shot in particular, I guess it's, what is it, page 36. It's when he goes up into the Jeffrey's tubes and his feet are all you see going up into the skylight.
Yeah.
And they're like the hoofness of them is really not pronounced. And then the next shot, they just look like superhero feet.
Right.
You know?
Vera is really like the sort of hands-off, like terrorism delegation style manager of this thing, like a Hans Gruber. Mm-hmm. So she's like radioing her units and they are not radioing back. And it's at this point she understands there to be a problem.
Yeah.
The double cross is apparent at this point.
I guess the idea is that she is like abandoning her Orion ship in order to take this over, essentially. Like,
it's a trade-up.
Maybe leaving a skeleton crew behind. And she gloats for a second, like, oh, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to sell this ship and retire, or, you know, use it as my future piracy flagship? So it seems like whatever she has been operating from, she considers to be disposable. But when she realizes the double cross is happening, she's like, get more guys over here, like, as fast as possible, because a single man is taking everybody out two at a time.
This is the essential weakness of the end boss in most cases, like the pre-gloat. You can't be pre-gloating lest you ruin your chances of a real gloat later. Sometimes if you gloat too fast, it just ruins it for everyone. Sometimes you'll want to get that gloat out of the way before you beam over to the Discovery, so you've got nothing in the chamber.
So and I guess what Saru arranged with the Dorothy Garad before, because there's that brief moment where he gets on FaceTime with them before the Orions take over the Disco, and it's like, you know, we don't have much time, and then cut to something else. So, but what he arranged with them was that Tilly was going to use the sensors on the Dorothy Garad to figure out whence the Orions are beaming to the Disco. Like, if they're actually looking for the signal, it makes it easier to spot where they're coming from. So they're able to pinpoint where the Orion ship is, and Saru gets on FaceTime with Vera to explain this to her, and she's like, I'm gonna blow up the garage now, and he's like, not so fast, that's not where I'm at.
Yeah, he's in the ready room, which is the last place that the units searched. Like, it's right off of the bridge.
They like looked in there and they saw they saw Captain Lorca's fortune cookies still in there, and they're like, oh, I don't mess with carbs at all. Like, you can't keep this going if you eat cookies just on a whim. So don't even bother going in there.
Yeah.
They look great, Adam.
They really do. Got some gains goals.
I know.
For me. Like, they aren't super, like, they aren't grotesquely jacked. They're just in very good shape. And that's like, that's like an attainable goal, I think.
I've been trying to get in better shape lately. My wife, not into it.
What?
Yeah.
She's like discouraging of this, or?
She's like, yeah, you look a little too skinny now.
Whoa.
Yeah. She wants a thick husband. Apparently. She wants me a bit more of a thick king.
That husband thick. Ben, I disagree.
Yeah, but you and I almost never have sex, so.
Wow. What are you going to do? Are you going to secretly get in shape? You going to hide it from her?
I'm doing this for me, okay?
Yeah, clearly. As you should. So, as anyone should. Look, personal growth comes from within. It shouldn't be done for anyone else but the person.
Yeah. But I also do want to be attractive to my wife. So I do feel like there is somewhat of a puzzle here. So
wow.
I don't know. I got to figure out what the solution is, cuz I do think that there's probably a happy medium.
Were you a puffy guy when she first met you?
I would say when she first met me, I'm skinnier now than I have been at any time since high school. So I think probably I was like at a midpoint between where I am now and where I was when I decided I needed to take a little bit of action on my own behalf.
Yeah.
But I also like, I'm not muscly at all. I have no muscles.
Yeah, because you know, your methods so far have been about like active walking and diet, right?
Yeah, it's all been cardio and diet. Yeah. So maybe I should get some maybe she would like it if I had muscles. I don't know. I don't really know how to get them.
Well, I'll tell you how to get them, Ben. You need to pick things up and then put them down over and over and over again.
I don't know. Sounds like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. I've been a 4 times to the gym a week person, I think, for the last several months, and not seeing big gains, which is fine. Like, I'm getting stronger, but I'm not getting jacked, and that's fine, because even when I worked out a ton, I never got jacked. I just got, like, lowercase s shredded.
I think jackedness is not available to certain body types.
I think I am that type of body, for sure.
Yeah.
I would settle for feeling better about myself, but that is the highest mountain that I could possibly climb. So, good luck.
Yeah. Saru pretty much has her dead to rights here, because the Dorothy Garrod has a gun to the back of the Orion ship's head. I mean, we never see the Orion ship, right?
No, and we see it on a view screen, and it kind of looks like a Star Wars ship.
Oh, yeah, it does have a little bit of it, like the icon.
Yeah.
Like the tactical icon looks like a TIE fighter, right?
Yeah, what does that suggest?
I was wondering if that's like a saucer section and two nacelles that are kind of beside it.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it from the top down?
Yeah, the ship could be spherical, and then like the targeting scanner could be the two slash lines also.
Yeah. Do we ever see the Garrod from the outside?
Yeah, we do in the first part of the comic. The first half, we see it. It's really fucked up looking.
I don't remember what it looks like.
Yeah, so maybe that is the Garrod, because its nacelles are to the side of the saucer like that.
Yeah, it's got the star drive section like directly below the saucer, and then the nacelles come up on either side like a bracket.
I don't like the proportions of my ships that way. I like them stretched out. Like a doggy on a couch, like legs forward and back.
I would say that the explodiness of the nacelles has me thinking that it makes a lot of sense to put them somewhat aft of the saucer section, you know?
Keep them away from the people.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, even just a little bit, you know, could be the difference between life and death.
You know, like in a lot of... In a lot of war movies, you'll see fighter jets hit buttons and release their fuel tanks in order to go faster or be more maneuverable or whatever. You never see a Federation starship eject the warp nacelles for any reason. They're always wanting to eject the core, but not the nacelles. I wonder if that's a thing that they're able to do ever.
We're halfway through Deep Space Nine at this point in our... In our watch through of Star Trek on the Greatest Generation, have we ever actually seen a warp core come out of a ship, or is it always that the ejection system is offline?
God, I don't know.
They talk about that all the fucking time.
Yep. Such a tease.
Can you eject the core?
I'm trying. It's not working.
Well, anyways, the Orions, they basically have them dead to rights. So Saru basically offers... I mean, I would say that he offers them a way better deal than they deserve, which is like put everybody back on board their ships, and we won't even seek to bring you to justice.
A ship that I don't believe is disabled in any way, like, would still be able to do the same shit next to the Nebula to someone else.
Right. A surprising amount of restraint. I wonder what the captain of the Garrod thinks about this, because it's also like she's also a captain, and Saru is just a commander who's got a temporary captain gig.
You meet her for a moment, Captain Holden. You meet her for a moment in that first half of the comic. You don't really see her or hear from her again, ever in this ep. And I think the button on the story may may explain this a little bit, Ben. We come to learn over dinner between Michael and Saru that Saru will not have the acting part of the acting captain title changed to permanent captain. He will not be the captain at all. And I think a big reason for that would be his conduct on this mission. He let the Orions go, A. And then two, he made it into a solo mission where he just ran around incapacitating people. And then three, like never communicates with Starfleet at all about his conditions or his circumstances. Like this rogue mission by Saru, I think is
Yeah, he was never even radioing with Reginald Vell Johnson.
Yeah, not a good look. So I actually side with Starfleet on the not promoting of him, because the very last frame is the very first scene in season two. It's their it's their meeting with the Enterprise.
And it's his personal log kind of making peace with the idea that this is not, it is not yet his time to be captain, but he needs to be cool with that. He needs to be like, he needs
Saru's
to see.
Saru's log, mistakes were made. End of log.
Well, I mean, mistakes were made, and I think he's acknowledging that, but also trying to see the good in that. Like, this was a... This was genuinely a learning opportunity, and that's good. And I think that that's a cool message. Like, and I think cool that this world can have a message like that. Like, everything doesn't need to be an unqualified success to be to like provide movement in a positive direction.
My thoughts might be best contained within a "Did you like this?" segment of the show, Ben.
Well, did you like this segment of the comic book, Adam?
I mean, that's, I think that's my problem with this issue, is that the stakes were always ever so low, even though, like, on paper, if you're looking at things bullet pointed out, the stakes are extremely high. Like, over dinner, Michael, all Michael talks about is the bet she has with Saru about whether or not he'd be captain. And not ever about the idea that she was marooned in an Orion prison and about to be sold into slavery.
Well, I don't think we saw their entire dinner.
Yeah, I mean, this is Paris. This is a three-hour dinner situation.
Yeah, I mean, the French really, they really know how to do it. I was sad to see Paris has lifted all of the height restrictions on construction, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Paris is a beautiful city, but all those skyscrapers seem unnecessary to me.
Yeah, they ruin the skyline for you.
Yeah, I mean, the Eiffel Tower should stand alone. That's my opinion. If anybody in the urban planning department of the city of Paris wants the opinions of one asshole, holler at your boy.
Yeah. I think my issues with the comic are about stakes, primarily. Like, there's... It's super fun.
Oh, is that what they're eating at dinner at the end?
It's fun, but it's toothless. And it feels like a comic for someone who... This is going to sound like negative, but it feels like a comic for a kid to enjoy. Because the violence is very cartoonish. The stakes are very low. It leans into, like... You really need to make some leaps to get with the idea of Saru one man teaming the mission here at the end. Like, these are fully armed Orion units that he is dispatching with ease, and there's never any question about his ability to do that. And I just, it never felt like anyone was in real danger, and that felt like a missed opportunity. The comic itself, like, is beautiful and great, as all of these Star Trek Discovery comics are. But it felt like the stakes for the Klingon comics were a little higher, and I kind of missed that intensity. What about you?
I mean, I think that I like it more than you did, from what I can tell. I do agree that it does wind up feeling a little trite, but what I wound up appreciating about it was the, like, personal growth that Saru is able to find in it, in spite of it not having been a great success.
Yeah.
So And I think it's like, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about season two. Like if you imagine that this is the thing that immediately preceded season two, like this is what is on Saru's mind when he's on the bridge, when they encounter the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Is like a pretty wild thing to think about. And it also makes me want more in the show of Saru going on one man, Ronin missions.
Yeah.
Like I do really want to see him fucking shred some baddies.
Right. Like weaponized Saru has always been on the table and it's so rarely deployed in a story. I do really like that. It's sort of like how Data was used fairly often in TNG as a perfect weapon, but only in the context of him going rogue. You know, like he was infrequently deployed as a one-man wrecking crew, you know, for the purposes of helping Picard.
Right. Well, Adam, do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages in the inbox?
Yeah, let's do it.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Well, Adam, no Priority One messages for this episode, but if folks would like Priority One messages, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where a personal message is $100 and a commercial message is $200, and help us make this program possible. Squarespace. Got to build yourself a website if you want to stand out online. Social media websites are not cutting it anymore, and you really can't tell the story of what you do and sell your products or services or time effectively without a really great looking website. Squarespace is the way to do it. Using Squarespace Blueprint, you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options. You make a seamless checkout option for your customers. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Amazing. So head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast. And we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda.
Yeah, I think I got a double Shimoda, the Orions that get their heads coconutted.
Mm.
Just like imagining the process of being a space warrior who has committed himself to being a big, muscly, scary man with a giant gun. And there's two of those guys who wind up going out by just getting their noggins bonked together. That's very Shimoda to me.
That is not a great way to go out, right?
No.
Kind of embarrassing.
It's by far the most embarrassing. Like the ones that get gassed in the arboretum, like, you know, you can't control that.
Once you come to, I feel like you make a deal with the other guy who you've been coconutted against and you're like, we're not going to tell anyone about that, right? Other guys like, yeah.
Saru is surprisingly good at sneaking, given the fact that he has hooves. Like, wouldn't he be clopping up behind people?
Boy, he really would be. He wears boots on the ship, though, right? That's why you don't hear him on the show.
Yeah, maybe he's got, like, memory foam horseshoes.
Yeah, he's got Skechers.
Did you have a drunk Shimoda?
It's hard for me to choose anyone besides Saru himself. And I say that because if at any point someone walked into the ready room and just shot him, the mission's over, the crew is sold into slavery, and Vera has all of the ships.
All of them.
It seems like the stakes are so high, and to place himself and only himself in harm's way seems like a stakes to the thing that, like, it's too much to bet on yourself.
What's the plan B if this doesn't work, Saru?
Maybe you just run out of runway. Like, you work within the confines of the 50 pages you get.
Right.
But I wonder if this was a 75-page annual, if there weren't a plan B on the table that we would have understood at that point.
Yeah, I found myself wondering, is this an amount of writing that is commensurate with, like, an episode, or is this a short treks? Like, how much content is here if this was shot and put up on screen? It seems like 20 or 30 minutes worth, right?
There is a really neat thing at the end of this comic where they show you how a comic goes from bullet points into production.
Oh, yeah.
And it really looks like the sort of outline you would see before writing a script. It's just, and there's no format to it, which is interesting. They're like, you know, creatives who work in comics just agree on a format that's understandable to all parties. And so the creatives involved here just kind of number out the pages and then what they want to see on those pages. And then interpretations are made by the inkers, the colorists, and those that do the text. I guess that doesn't quite answer your question, but it seems like if you're constructing a story, you're at least beginning with an outline in a script-like conventional way.
Like, the thing that is coloring our thinking about this is that in film production, there's a very standardized format for screenplays,
right.
And there's, like, a reason for that, which is that the math of one page equals 1 minute of screen time tends to be pretty consistent with the format that everybody uses, and, like, literally everybody uses it. So if you see a script on a table, like, just based on its thickness, you can estimate what kind of thing you're looking at, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting, though, like, at the end of this comic, when you see how that sausage gets made, I rarely get that when you're doing pre-script outlines, you're hammering the visual as much. And I understand with comics, that's almost entirely the point. But to, like, begin with the visual and then backfill with story was such an interesting technique to see being used. Like, I want to believe that you have a lot of control from the start about how many pages it takes to tell certain parts of a story.
Yeah. We should try and write a comic sometime.
Yeah, we've got friends in the biz.
It all starts with an 8-ball of Coke.
I even have the seeds of an idea.
That sounds threatening.
Oh, yes.
Well, we have friends in the comics industry. We also have friends of the greatest discovery, the greatest of which being Rob Schulte, who is the producer of the show. At this point,
sure,
I think we will hand it off to him.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast, hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to support the ongoing production of our show. And a nice free way to support the show is to head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. All right, thanks. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.